WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Russia has condemned the bombing of Serbia. Last week, it called for a meeting with the foreign ministers of the world's seven leading industrial powers to negotiate a political settlement. Today, a Russian intelligence gathering ship arrived in the Mediterranean with the stated purpose of monitoring NATO forces. Six other Russian ships are on standby in the Black Sea. But Moscow insists that Russia will not enter the war. We invited Fred Hyatt to talk with us about Russia's relationship with Serbia. Hyatt is a member of the editorial page staff of The Washington Post. He covered Russia for The Post from 1991 to 95. Russia is weak now. I asked if that makes Russia less dangerous, but also more unpredictable.
In some ways, I think Russia's weakness is what makes it dangerous now. It's less dangerous in the sense that its military is falling apart, and they're unlikely to intervene in a military sense. They would be unable to do much below the nuclear level, of course. But their weakness makes them dangerous in all kinds of ways. And most fundamentally, I think in some ways, it's what makes them identify with Serbia in this conflict and feel so outraged by what NATO is doing.
In what sense do you think it's identifying with Serbia?
I think Russia looks at itself now as the victim, the underdog, and the United States, first of all, and NATO, second, is a big bully. A lot of Russians feel this way, not all Russians, but that the United States has been kind of trying to dictate to Russia for the past 7 or 8 years, and now they see NATO doing the same thing to Serbia, and a lot of people are outraged by it. The sympathy, people tend to portray Russia's sympathy for Serbia right now as a kind of historical thing, you know, Slav brotherhood and the Orthodox religion, and all of which is true. But I think this sense of being in the same position in the world and being at the receiving end of NATO imperialism is a much stronger factor in the emotional response to what NATO's doing.
Well, you know, getting back to how weak Russia is now, Russia really needs money. It's looking for more money from the International Monetary Fund just to pay off loans that it has from the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
Is its weakened economic state making Russia a little more dangerous in the sense that its greatest export now is perhaps weapons and weapons components?
And weapons scientists. I think that's right. When the Soviet Union fell apart, the United States had a sense that Russia and the United States could work together in lots of ways because we would share an interest in, for example, preventing nuclear proliferation to Iran. And logically, that makes sense. You would not think that Russia would want Iran to be a nuclear power. Iran is a lot closer to Russia than it is to the United States. But part of the reason that shared interest has not translated into policy, as the United States hoped a few years ago, is that Russia is in no position to think of the long term. It's trying to survive sort of week to week, month to month, and its companies are trying to survive month to month. They're trying to pay their salaries. And if they can make a deal that can get them through the year, they're much less inclined to think about what the implications of that might be 10 years from now. If they were not so economically destitute, they might be more inclined to kind of share the U.S. perspective on issues like nonproliferation.
Has Russia been exporting arms to Serbia?
I don't think so. As far as I know, not. They have, there is an arms embargo on Yugoslavia, on the former Republic of Yugoslavia. And it's interesting that in the last week, despite all of the outrage in Moscow and the threats to suspend cooperation with NATO and do other kinds of things, the Russian government has not yet threatened to start selling arms to Serbia, although there are a lot of politicians in Moscow who want to do that. That would mean violating a United Nations embargo, and they don't seem ready to do that yet. But again, you know, things can happen on a governmental level. Things can happen on a company level. Sometimes a company can do it, and the government can claim it has no control over it, which in Russia today is believable, but also hard to prove. And, you know, that's been one of the frustrations of the U.S. government in trying to get a handle on this issue.
Do you see an alliance forming between Serbia, Iraq, and Russia? Iraq and Serbia being two rogue states that, you know, have embargoes against them.
When you look at Russia's role in the world, there isn't any natural reason why it should be allying with Serbia and Iraq, or with Serbia, Iraq, and, you know, North Korea, or the bad guys in the world. I mean, Russia is a democracy today. In the long run, it will not be served well by a lot of other countries getting nuclear weapons. But what it shares with them is an absence of influence. And to some extent, it may feel as though the only way it can make itself felt in the world is to cause trouble, which is sort of the definition of a rogue state. I mean, we pay attention to North Korea because North Korea threatens South Korea and Japan and everybody else with missiles, or because it's going to sell missile technology to other countries, or because it's developing nuclear weapons. If it wasn't doing those bad things, we would ignore it. It can wield no positive influence in the world. And unfortunately, Russia, to some extent, is coming to that position. It can't contribute much. Its economy is something, although it's the biggest country in the world, its economy is like 1% of world GDP right now. So, you know, Yeltsin, President Boris Yeltsin, wanted to be one of the G8. The G7, you know, is the seven industrialized rich countries. He wanted to make it to the G8. And the United States kind of went along and invited Yeltsin to some of these meetings. But it's a pretense, because Russia has nothing to contribute to the world economy or to world economic stabilization. So there's a temptation for it to say, well, if the only way I can make a difference is by making trouble or by joining alliances with other troublemaking states, better to be paid attention to than to be ignored. And that's the challenge for U.S. policymakers, I think.
One of the things that Russia, Iraq, and Serbia have in common is using force and terror to try to keep breakaway republics from leaving. You know, with the Kurds in Iraq, Kosovo in Serbia, Chechnya for Russia. Do you think that that's something that's uniting them as well?
I think it's certainly a factor for Russian policymakers. Chechnya has a lot of similarity to Kosovo, as you say. It's a Muslim insurgency. The Russian army was absolutely brutal in Chechnya. I mean, the things they did definitely were comparable to what Milosevic's forces were doing in Kosovo, at least up until the last week or two. You know, they went in and just destroyed one village after another. And I think they find it alarming that NATO is, in their view, setting a precedent that other countries have the right to interfere in what they regarded as an internal affair. I think this is a factor for China, too, which has not only Tibet, but a Muslim, if not an insurgency, certainly a lot of, you know, independence-minded people on its western border, and also would feel very threatened by the idea that other countries would have any right to say whether, you know, what should happen to Tibet. So that's certainly a factor for the leadership. Whether it's a factor for ordinary Russians, less so. I think, you know, because the war in Chechnya was very unpopular in Russia, and I think most Russians these days would say, boy, if Chechnya wants to go, good riddance, let him go.
My guest is Fred Hyatt. He covered Russia for The Washington Post from 1991 to 95. He's now on the Post's editorial page staff. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Hyatt. He's a member of the editorial page staff of The Washington Post and was the Post's Russian correspondent from 1991 to 95. NATO just very recently expanded, and there are former Soviet bloc countries in NATO, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary. NATO was formed basically to stare down the Soviet threat. Do you think that this NATO attack, because there's Soviet bloc countries now in NATO, is especially threatening to Russia?
I think they say it's threatening to them. They say they feel threatened by it. I think what they're really saying is that when NATO expanded, it tried to reassure Russia by saying that it's not an aggressive alliance, that it's purely defensive. And although the Russians never really accepted that, they took it as some reassurance, I guess. And then they say, look, a month after you let in these three countries who are practically on our borders, you're launching an aggressive action against an independent sovereign nation. Now, you know, that's not exactly how NATO sees it. It's not how I see it. But it has definitely confirmed for a lot of Russians their worst fears about what NATO is, and their worst fears about the reliability of U.S. promises as NATO continues to expand.
Who's in control in Russia now? Is it Primakov or Yeltsin, and what's their relationship to each other?
I'd say nobody is in control. That's, in some ways, I suppose, one of the signs of progress in Soviet days. There's been a lot of diffusion of power to the regions and to other institutions, but it's also a little bit one of the scary things right now. Yeltsin is very sick, quite weak, only sporadically engaged, and yet enough of a presence to make sure that nobody else can be entirely in control. Primakov, the prime minister, who was sort of seen as a caretaker when he was appointed last fall, has gone a long way to establishing his power and bringing a lot of his old buddies from the intelligence world into positions of influence. His poll ratings are quite high, and so he's also very influential. Under the Constitution, Yeltsin could fire Primakov, as he has fired previous prime ministers when they get too much power, but there's a lot of speculation that he couldn't get away with it this time, that he's just too weak, and so that's the source of Primakov's power, and there's a lot of jockeying going on between the two of them and between their various power bases. And then you throw other folks into the mix who would like to become president to replace Yeltsin, and you get a very unstable situation.
Is Primakov an old Cold War guy?
He's an old Cold War guy. I myself don't think he's changed all that much. You know, he was sort of a moderate reformer type under Gorbachev. He wasn't the most unreconstructed of the Soviet men. But he was never a reformer who would really go out on a limb and commit himself to anything. He's very cautious. And I think he still pretty much sees the world through the eyes of somebody raised in the Soviet system. In his old days, he developed good relations with Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, how did they know each other?
He was a journalist. Primakov was a journalist who traveled in the Middle East a lot. It's often said that, oh, he must have been KGB while he was doing that. Nobody has ever, you know, established that. And I think there's a good chance he wasn't in the crudest sense, but nobody in those days traveled without sort of having the approval of and being willing to, or I shouldn't say nobody, but almost nobody, being willing to report to the KGB. And certainly nobody could have the kind of contacts he did with leadership in countries like Syria and Iraq without very much having the blessing of the, what the Russians call the organs back home, meaning the intelligence organs. And he developed very close relations with these folks who we don't consider particularly savory characters, and those have persisted. And even more than that, I think what's persisted, or what is uppermost in his mind now, is preventing the United States from establishing what he sees as a unipolar world. Primakov very much distrusts the United States, as he always has. He understands that Russia by itself no longer has the power to stand up to the United States as the other great power. But by maneuvering, by forming alliances and reforming them and finding friends in different situations in different places, he can make life very difficult for the United States. And if it's Iraq now and Serbia tomorrow and maybe Iran the next day, that's what he'll do. And he's convinced that the United States is focused on weakening Russia, and he's just responding to that.
Does Primakov have a personal relationship with Milosevic?
I don't think they're particularly good friends. That was not Primakov's part of the world. Certainly, they know each other, and I don't know if you saw the pictures when Primakov went there a couple days after the war had started. They were arm in arm and grinning together and joking. Not a mention from Russia about what Serbia is doing in Kosovo, about the ethnic cleansing, about the atrocities. That just doesn't even come up in Russian official statements.
If the war widens, do you think Russia would play a big part in it?
I'm not sure what scenario I can imagine. Militarily they are extremely weak. They could not control, the entire Russian army was incapable of putting down a rebellion in a very small province, that is Chechnya. I mean, the Russian army was defeated there inside its own country. And it was defeated in part because it is just so impoverished. Russian soldiers, would go out and pretend to fight the Chechens during the day, and at night they would go sell their guns to the Chechen rebels because they weren't being fed by the Russian army. Even when I was in Moscow a couple of years ago, I wrote stories about Navy recruits literally starving to death out in the Far East because the rations never got there. Most of their planes can't fly. Most of the ships never put out to sea. It is no longer a superpower or even really a power in a military sense, again, except for that very large exception, which is the strategic nuclear arsenal. So, if no matter what happens, if this remains a Balkan conflict, it's hard to imagine Russia intervening in a military sense and being any kind of a threat or a force. But if it, if it chose to supply experts or arms or make trouble in other ways, in that rogue state kind of way that we've talked about, it could definitely be a factor.
Russia's involvement in the war so far has been one that they would probably describe as trying to press for peace. They've pushed for peace negotiations, and they've sent 7 ships out to the area, saying that the ships were just to monitor what's going on, not to create war, not to participate in the war. I'm wondering what your interpretation is of the Russian moves so far.
I think the main motivation is that Russia wants to be a player. And they were happy to be one of the contact group and to sort of play the role of responsible negotiator, one of the 6 big powers, as long as they could do that without kind of taking any responsibility, as you said, and pushing Milosevic to do his part. Now that that failed, they don't quite know what role to play. If they could come back in as a peacemaker, I think they would be delighted to do that. They have not taken the most radical steps that they could, indicating that they really don't want to sever their ties with the West. To some extent, I think the government is responding to pressure from the parliament, it's being pushed rather than leading. And, you know, I think it's worth remembering that Yeltsin still sees his legacy as the person who brought Russia into the world. He has been the westernizer. He has been the guy who was going to have Russia take its place as a power, but as a democratic power respected by the other democratic powers. And for him to give that up now would be basically to say that his two terms have been a failure. So to the extent that he has influence, I think he will still try and work to keep Russia from entirely finding itself on the side of Milosevic, completely cast out from the responsible big power world. Whether they can kind of maintain that stay on that tightrope, you know, will depend on how long the war goes on and what course it takes.
Well, Fred Hyatt, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Fred Hyatt is on the editorial page staff of The Washington Post and is the Post's former Russian correspondent. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.